From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what happened when Albion High School closed its doors, sending its students to nearby Marshall High?
What you find in the end is that these kids are getting along. A lot of the reaction they're getting to the story is that we get along better than what you say.
And we look at the many ways children in Michigan are slipping further and further away from their chances at a successful life.
It's very troubling to look at these statistics and think about it, what it means in terms of the future of our state and our ability to be competitive.
And Medicaid opens today to hundreds of thousands of low-income Michiganders.
What makes Michigan's plan unique is that there are also co-pays and premiums for new enrollees.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Today is the day. After months and months and months of debate, Healthy Michigan is finally here. That's the official name for the state's newly expanded Medicaid program. Today on Stateside, who is eligible for the new coverage and why are other states looking to Michigan for lessons learned? I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, it made news. The merger between financially struggling Albion High School and its neighbor, Marshall High. Now more than halfway through the school year, we check in to see how the students are faring. But first, to another hugely surprising retirement from Congress. Republican Congressman Dave Camp, who represents Michigan's 4th District, has announced he will not run again for re-election. He's served in Congress for 24 years and has been chair of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee. Joining us now are Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, co-hosts of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Hi, you two.
Hello, Cindy.
Hello.
Let me ask our two political gurus here, how surprised were you by Dave Camp's announcement, Zoe?
Oh, actually, Rick and I were on the line with each other when this news came down, and we had been hearing for a couple hours that maybe it was coming, and both of us were like, no, after the Rogers announcement, could it be? I mean, believing it could happen, but the fact that Mike Rogers, another powerful, influential congressman, surprised us all last Friday, this news came out yesterday afternoon. I think it's fair to say, even though there was some gossip about it, we were pretty shocked.
Yeah, we were surprised, and it was because, you know, that we've just had this wave of congressional retirements. And we've had more, I think that Michigan is probably losing more years per capita in Congress than any other state. So, you know, that we thought that after we saw, you know, Senator Levin and then John Dingell and Mike Rogers, you know, all announcing that they were going to leave, that Camp was not going to be the next shoe to drop.
Right.
And then there he was.
And why now? How do you think this is?
That is the question. You know, some people are talking about this cancer scare that the congressman had in 2012, but then his doctor said he was cancer free a short time later. In fact, we figured he was healthy enough that his name was actually on the list to possibly be a Republican Senate candidate last year when Carl Levin's Senate seat opened. Congressman Mike Rogers' name was also on this list.
And both of them said that their committee responsibilities was a big part of what kept them out of the United States Senate race. And now we're seeing both Rogers and Camp now retiring from Congress.
And look, Rogers has been offered a radio show. He will be a national radio host focusing on foreign affairs, national security issues. This is his bailiwick as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. With Camp, it's a little different. He's 60, so he still has some years in his career that maybe he wants to be in the private sector and make some money. We are seeing Congress people do this. This right now is a Congress that is not getting a lot done. It is an unpopular Congress. And so we are seeing actually, in fact, I think the number was 33 or 34 congressmen, congresswomen deciding to retire after this election. 33, 34, that is a big number.
And including some lions of the institution, you know, that if you enjoy, like I do, saying sex be Chandless, well, you know, get it done now because he's retiring. Henry Waxman, who is also John Dingell's nemesis, are both Democrats, is retiring. So we're seeing a lot of it. And what we're hearing from a lot of these old lions is that Congress just isn't as rewarding as it used to be, that it's difficult to get things done, that as an institution, it's become more partisan. You know, in the case of Dave Camp in particular, that he had made – a tax overhaul, doing something to, you know, simplify the tax code, you know, make it more manageable and less expensive was going to be his crowning achievement. But then Democratic counterpart, Max Baucus, in the Senate, retired early. He's now the U.S. ambassador to China, which makes that task that much harder. That Camp is termed out as chair of the House Ways and Committee after this year. And so it seems like maybe it just became a sort of a what's the point of it going forward.
And that's what I think I might be hearing between the lines of what you're all saying, is that maybe it isn't how much is the paycheck. What's this bottom line? Dollars and cents, but this, we use the term, and so much it's become cliche, but the gridlock on Capitol Hill, got to wear people out. It has to wear people out psychically and spiritually and all that energy that they may have brought at the beginning.
In the best of times.
At the best of times,
And what we're seeing is they are getting other offers, right? Mm-hmm. And big paycheck offers, which in some cases is alluring, and that is what they want to go do, no doubt about it.
Well, I don't think we don't know that that's the case with Dave Camp, that we know that, you know, in the case of Mike Rogers, that he sees this not just as a money-making opportunity, but as an agenda-setting opportunity, a way to be influential, that he could be even a way that he was not as a member of Congress. And, you know, I think that, you know, Senator Levin and Congressman Dingell, well, you know, their reputations are established and, you know, they're kind of riding into the sunset.
Yeah. And we should note that Rogers, in talking to the Washington Post, actually said he's hoping this radio show actually helps affect the election come 2016. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at least for Rogers, he still wants to remain in the political fold. He's just going about it in a different way.
Well, as you had said earlier, Zoe, we've got, you know, four members of Michigan's congressional delegation to lay down their arms and say, all right, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, what does this mean for Michigan's clout in Congress?
Well, we actually did some math.
Crunched
some
numbers.
Together, we are actually losing more than 130 years of combined experience with these four members of Michigan's congressional delegation leaving.
And by experience, we mean seniority. And remember, we're losing some House seniority, too, with Gary Peters, who is leaving the 14th district to run for the Senate.
Absolutely. So, you know. And let's not forget, too, John Conyers of Detroit is going to be facing an interesting primary challenge. He's going to have to work for this seat.
So, got a lot of baggage.
Indeed. Yeah. And this is going to affect Michigan. I mean, no doubt about it. Rick and I were just talking a little bit ago about all of the issues right now facing Congress that actually have some really serious implications for our state.
Let's look at some current controversies, issues that are still hanging fire. And we've got the new international bridge in Detroit that Congress still has not appropriated the $250 million for the Customs Plaza. Getting that done will require some congressional clout. A lot of businesses in Michigan that have an interest in immigration reform, both our agricultural sector and Governor Snyder considers that a part of the revitalization of Detroit. Also a part of the revitalization of Detroit, but something that has implications, at least across the Lower Peninsula, is transportation funding. That is an absolute competition among the states, and it is just raw votes and influence. And, you know, we're talking about mass transit systems in Metro Detroit and in Grand Rapids. It'll have, you know, an issue on this. And remember, too, you know, invasive species. Right now, Michigan is staring down Chicago, the shipping industry, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do something and quickly about the threat posed by the Asian carp. And what Michigan wants is a really, really big ask, a permanent separation of the Mississippi water systems and the Great Lakes at a cost of billions with a B of dollars.
All of that needs some very heavy, heavy muscle in Congress.
Well, and there's also, let's remember the things that we can't even imagine happening that we might want some Michigan love in Congress for. I mean, look at the auto bailout. Mm-hmm. Think about if we had not had these really, really powerful chairmen, congressional representatives going, we need this auto industry.
Making those phone calls.
Exactly, during that bailout. Yeah. One can imagine what could have happened. So you can look to the future and go, what issues might come up that we can't even predict that not having Michigan clout and seniority might actually affect?
So here we have campaigns heating up for Rogers' seat in the 8th, and now Camp's in the 4th. And really,
don't forget the 14th.
And the 14th. So there's really only days to determine who's going to run. So what do you both see for election 2014?
Well, and this is what part of it is just so crazy, is we're now at about 3 weeks. So come April 22nd, you have to file your petition signatures, 1,000 valid legal signatures to be able to run. So you've got 3 weeks to get these campaigns up and going. That takes organization. That takes money. That takes get out the vote efforts. So this takes people who probably have name recognition or are able to self-finance, people who can quickly jump in this race and get going.
You know, it's also the question now, you know, a lot of different interests are going to be, you know, asking themselves, you know, with the loss of all this clout, what are we going to be looking for? And I would say a couple of things that they'll be on the lookout for. One is youth, someone who's experienced, certainly, but is young enough to hang around for
a
while.
Could be the next John Dingell.
You know, and gain some of that clout. But to do that, that also means you really have to have star quality. You have to go to D.C., be identified as an up-and-comer, and then once you're identified as an up-and-comer, it kind of happens. And so, you know, we're going to be looking for some real high-powered political talent to go and try and, you know, vault past the just straight-up seniority system to gain some recognition and influence in D.C.
What's really going to be so interesting to watch now is just this election in Michigan come November. I mean, this is going to be insane. We have the entire state house, the entire state senate, the governor, the attorney general, the secretary of state. We have an open senate seat, plus all of these now new open congressional seats. This is going to be an election to watch. There is going to be millions of dollars spent. And of course, we can't forget also all of the ballot initiatives that will most likely make their way onto the November ballot.
So I can just see both of you rubbing your hands with glee. Well, thanks for breaking this all down as we all realize, my goodness, our fourth congressional member has decided to hang it up with Dave Camp's announcement. And of course, we've been talking with Michigan Radio's Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, the hosts of It's Just Politics. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
My pleasure, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 50 Michigan school districts ended the last fiscal year in the red. All of that leads to talk of consolidation, of mergers, streamline, become more efficient, join forces. But as policymakers, educators, and parents debate the merits of consolidation and merging, how about those who will feel what it's like day in and day out? The students and their teachers. That's the question Bridge magazine writer Ron French explores in his series of reports for Bridge called 13 Miles to Marshall. When struggling Albion High School closed at the end of the last school year, it meant over 150 Albion high schoolers had to be bused to nearby Marshall High School. It made sense in business terms for both districts to do this. Ron, Albion Superintendent Jerry Lynn Williams Harper actually was the one to present the high school.
Both districts were struggling financially. Marshall, a little less than Albion, but they both were running in deficit. Albion had over $1 million in deficit that they didn't know how they could handle. They'd already cut to the bone. They had closed six schools in 15 years already. They were down to basically one school and a high school. They were down to virtually no extracurriculars of any kind. They lost their football team. They were losing more than half of their children through school of choice to surrounding school districts. They were in a death spiral. Marshall, which if you go there, it's a cute little town, mm-hmm. and the high school is sparkling and it's had a lot of renovations to it. Yet even in a situation like that, they were losing money. They had about $1 million that they didn't know how they were going to have to replace.
Where did that come from? Why was that? Were they losing students as well?
They were losing students as well. They were losing a net of between 300 and 400 students a year through school of choice. And if you add that up by 7,000, you're talking about $2 million right there every year that they're having to replace because kids are choosing to go elsewhere.
So Jerry Lynn Williams Harper of Albion says to Randall Davis, my babies need to be at Marshall. So it happened.
That's right. That's right.
And when I think of we should also note, this was not a consolidation of districts. This was just of the high school. So Albion retained its K-8 classes, and it's still an independent district.
Absolutely it is. The reason that works is because high schools are much more expensive to operate than elementary schools. So by getting rid of their high school, they were able to save a lot of money. Now, Marshall had room in their existing high school for the approximately 150, 160 kids mm-hmm. that they were going to take from Albion. So all they had to do was hire about three or four more teachers. And yet they were getting those 150 kids times $7,000, and it eliminated their deficit.
What were – before it all began, is it was all worked out on paper and the grown-ups all decided what was going to happen for these kids – what were the biggest, apart from the dollars and cents, what were the pros? What were the Albion students going to gain by going to Marshall?
The Albion students were going to gain a lot of opportunities mm-hmm. that they did not have at Albion High School. In the last year of Albion High School, they had three clubs, extracurricular clubs. At Marshall, they have over 30. They had eight sports teams left. And boys and girls each have about a dozen at Marshall High School. There are all sorts of opportunities. The play, the school play, that's just a tradition, right? They did have a play at Albion High School, but by that last year, it was a couple of chairs on a stage with just a canvas in the back that looked like a brick wall. By comparison, the production that Marshall is doing right now is Grease. They have a working car that drives out onto stage. They have 40 dancers who come out and hand jive across the stage. It's this huge production, and it's in this brand new 900-seat sparkling performing arts center right there on the campus of the school. You're getting a lot of opportunities, and this isn't a difference between Cynthia between being rich and poor, and there's nothing wrong with not having money. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly grew up poor, but these types of opportunities help kids grow. It helps them learn. It gives them a better chance at life once they get out of high school.
It certainly gives them a sense of being able to make it in the college world if they go on to college.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the risks. Again, on paper, as they all talked about it over the summer and planned for this to happen last fall, what were seen as the risks for both student bodies?
Yeah. Actually, both communities struggled with the idea. Mm-hmm. Management of both districts really wanted it, felt it was going to be a good idea for both economically for the districts and for the students. But there were a lot of parents in both districts who were not in favor of it at the time. In Albion, what you saw was two things. One was it's a majority African-American school, and there was some concern among parents as to how the African-American students were going to be accepted into a school that was over 90% white. Were they right to think that? Who knows? But I can tell you that at the time there was concern. And the other thing was, and this is something a lot of small towns go through, you know, I grew up in a tiny town, mm-hmm. and you saw people twice a week, once at church and once on Friday nights at the basketball games. You're taking away their basketball games. You're taking away their football games. Mm-hmm. What – you lose a sense of community when you lose your high school. Suddenly you can't – no one's wearing the Wildcat T-shirts anymore because the school does not exist anymore. At Marshall, there was a different concern, and there it was more – along the lines of what was going to happen to our high academic standards. Now, again, is that racially motivated by saying that? But the fact is that at the time, Marshall had very high standardized test scores. Albion did not. And so you're bringing in 150, 160 kids with lower test scores. Is this going to affect our standing? Are we not going to be the elite academic school in the county anymore?
Well, here we go. Here comes fall. There are 170 Albion students and administrators were guessing 120 or so of them would show up at Marshall High School. But on the first day of class, 160 showed up, which said they bought into it.
They bought into it, that everyone was going to give it a shot. And the reason they bought into it is because of the just amazing amount of spade work that the two superintendents did on this. They brought over the Albion students to Marshall High School last May or June for a day. They were met at the door by the marching band. They were led through this school by groups of students trying to make them feel welcome. In the summer, they had a symposium at Albion College for students from both schools where they spent the full weekend, and they intentionally roomed Albion students with Marshall students. you know, for the weekend. And they had all sorts of bonding activities. And so by the time September rolled around, a lot of kids knew each other, were feeling more comfortable about it. They were getting more excited about the opportunities.
So did the fears materialize, let's say, first of the Albion parents who were afraid that their black children were going to be marginalized in a white school?
Not really. No, not at all. There are going to be problems in every high school, no matter who.
Because it's high school.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But to answer the question, no. The kids have gotten along great. They've gotten along better than anyone expected, but gotten along better than the administrators who were proponents of this mm-hmm. expected even. The thing that is said over and over again by the students now, both from Marshall and Albion, is that this will work out fine if the adults get out of the way.
Well, in fact, I had to salute Marshall Senior Tierra Orban, and you have her quote in your story in Bridge. Here it is. It's the older generation that had problems. They said we wouldn't get along. They said when we go to school, we're not going to learn because we don't learn in the same way. But it was sweet. I have a big group of new friends.
That was great.
That was great. Did you hear similar things from Albion students?
Absolutely. The thing, though, there is still a transition going on.
Yes.
And let's be honest, it's a transition that's a lot easier for the Marshall students than it is for the Albion students. They're at the same school mm-hmm. with the same teachers, the same mascot. You know, this is a totally new thing for the Albion students. So the Albion students, if I had to generalize.
Yes.
Okay. Because, you know, you talk to 150 people, you get 150
sure.
different answers. But if I had to generalize, the sense is this is a good move. It's an absolutely great move in the long run. This is better for us academically. I know this is a good thing. But there are still times where I feel uncomfortable, where I don't feel like a part of the school yet.
Why is that?
Well, part of it, Cynthia, I think it's probably less racial than it – partly you're going to a school where – 700 of the students who are there know each other, have grown up together. And you're coming in to be about 15%, 20% of the student population knowing very few people. So there's some of that. And that transition will take care of itself after a few years.
Right.
But there is a little economics involved too because you have a situation where Marshall students are going to be very accepting, and they're very friendly. Mm-hmm. They think nothing of it. But there are things that Albion students will notice that Marshall students won't.
You commented on one of the Albion students saw a Marshall girl dragging her laptop by its cord, really not taking care of it at all, and thinking, I would never do that.
Right.
Those are the million and one things that emerge hour by hour as you go through your school day.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's this is not to blame – the Marshall kids in any way. You know, it's just a difference in background. And frankly, it's going to be good for the students from both those communities to be in school with people who are a little different from them because that's what life is going to be like, especially if they go to college and the workplace, wherever they go. They're going to be around people who sometimes don't look like them, sometimes have more money than them, and sometimes have less money than them.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Bridge Magazine writer Ron French, who explored the merger of Albion and Marshall High Schools in his series of reports for Bridge called 13 Miles to Marshall. What did you hear from the teachers? And I know you spent time especially with the English teacher Julie Smith observing her classes. So how did it work for them?
Yeah, absolutely. They did some work at the beginning trying to figure out, do we need to adjust how we teach or what we teach. And the impression was that everyone decided we're going to do the same lessons. We're not going to water this down because of students who may not have quite the academic background of some of the students we've taught before. And generally what they say, there are students who are on high honors at Marshall who live in Albion.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, some of them are struggling academically. Some of them, they move from higher level classes to lower level classes at the beginning of the year. A few have dropped out of AP classes. They're struggling because they don't have the sort of background. But what you're finding from the teachers is they are just so impressed with the resilience of these kids that they are in a new environment, sort of thing that I probably curl up in a ball in the corner and cry. But these kids are up at 5:30 every morning, getting on the bus to get there, spending all day. Sometimes they're there till 7 or 8 at night because they have extracurricular activities. They're doing their homework. And even when their grades are not quite what they were at Albion, they are really putting out an effort. And it's really inspiring to see how they're responding to this changed situation.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting as I read all four of your pieces in Bridge. There were an enormous amount of comments, and a lot of them were highly critical of you, of Julie Smith. Others were hotly defending Ms. Smith. Why do you think this drew such a very, very heated emotional response from your readers?
Yeah, I've wondered that myself. It was a little surprising to us, and it saddens us in some way because mm-hmm. we felt we were trying. We all felt at Bridge that, mm-hmm. that we felt so inspired by these kids, and we felt that this was a good example of how the system can work. But I think this is a situation where it's a story that really cuts to the bone. Mm-hmm. We're having people look in the mirror and saying that, yes, this person doesn't have the same income as this other person. Yes, this person has a different skin color. And does this make a difference? Generally, I think it does not in the long run. But we have to talk about this because, let's face it, you know, it's the elephant in the room. You know, this is why it was a problem last spring. This is a problem why other districts have not already done this, because they're not sure they want this sort of thing to happen in their communities. But what you find in the end is that these kids are getting along. A lot of the reaction they're getting to the story is that we get along better than what you say.
Which, in effect, I came away with a strong sense that it is hopeful and things are progressing, and Albion students are being lifted maybe to a higher level of effort and therefore achievement. You have kids hand jiving in – Albion kids are hand jiving in Greece and being part of things. There was that incident that you were – you observed in the English class, the AP English class, and there was a student-led discussion. And right. the Albion student, the African-American student, never got called on. Yeah. And people were angry at the teacher about that. But the point was she did make an observation, yet the students didn't call on this girl.
This is an exercise they do all the time mm-hmm. in this class, and I suspect in more than just that one class,
yeah.
where the teacher is trying to empower the students to lead the discussion. And the students talk about the book they were reading at the time. It was Brave New World.
Mm.
And – which was sort of ironic considering the story we were doing.
Yeah.
And then once that student spoke, the student called on another student to speak. And you saw them go around the room. They were sitting in a circle, in fact. And they would call on, as you'd expect, mm-hmm. in high school, you call on your friends.
Yeah.
Well, the one student in this class from Albion kept raising her hand to speak. And no one ever called on her. The teacher at one point, because she didn't want to interfere, but did say, urge the students, make sure everyone gets a chance to talk here. It didn't happen. And the girl was very frustrated. Was it a one-time thing? I was told later it was not a one-time thing. But I can tell you that also, would that have happened in other schools where every student is Caucasian and you're calling on your friends? It could have been.
Well, and then I can just say, based on a personal experience of having transferred in my 10th grade, 2 months into 10th grade, from a very small all-girls Catholic school to a very large public school, it has nothing to do
exactly. –
that feeling of being isolated had nothing to do with skin color. So you're just the outie from the new school. So you have to wonder how much of – that is because you're the new kid from the new school.
Absolutely. There was a freshman I spoke to
mm-hmm.
From Albion. So her first experience in high school has been at Marshall. And she was on the girls' freshman basketball team with a lot of girls from Marshall. And she has already plans for the summer where she's going to be spending the summer hanging out with her, you know, Caucasian middle class friends.
Her new friends.
Right. And so – that's what this school is going to be like in 2 or 3 years. There is going to be no Albion or Marshall. It's just going to be a Marshall High School.
So what lessons do you think this Albion-Marshall High School merger will teach other districts who are watching it closely and wrestling with their own deficits?
Take a chance and get it done. You see here, if it were going to fail, this would have been a place for it to fail because you had two very different communities. They were bitter rivals. On the sports field. And it's worked out tremendously. If it can work there, it can work in Pontiac. It can work in a lot of different places. It can work, you know. So we got to stop thinking of these mergers as it's us against them. We have to think what's best for the kids.
Ron French, his four-part report, 13 Miles to Marshall, can be found at Bridge Magazine. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
MLF Capital reporter Jonathan Osting joins us now. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So how has Medicaid eligibility expanded in Michigan as of today?
Well, as you mentioned, there are some unique twists here in Michigan. So first of all, we raised the cap on people who can qualify to 133% of the federal poverty level. That's something a lot of other states are doing. That's kind of how it was envisioned to work. But what makes Michigan's plan unique is that there are also co-pays and premiums for new enrollees, which can actually be reduced through healthy living behaviors such as quitting smoking or some other healthy behavior agreed upon with your doctor. So there's skin in the game, I guess you could say, but
yeah,
that skin can be reduced through behaviors that might reduce the overall cost of healthcare.
What was the idea behind getting the skin in the game and having beneficiaries chip in on their medical costs?
Well, I think that was part of the idea of selling this to a Republican-led legislature that is otherwise pretty opposed to the Affordable Care Act. Michigan, did not choose to set up its own exchange, which was allowable under the law. And Republicans did face a lot of backlash for going along with this Medicaid expansion. However, they were able to sell it as a reform plan rather than a simple expansion plan under the law, which I think, you know, went a long ways in winning over some of those members and potentially their constituents.
And there has to be a lot to like from a public health point of view for offering incentives for healthy behaviors.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, the Michigan Department of Community Health helped champion this and is pretty excited about it. The governor has often talked about healthy behaviors and has his own 4x4 plan to encourage, you know, things again, like stopping smoking or getting a regular physical. So certainly, you know, those incentives make a lot of sense from a public health perspective.
I'm speaking with MLive's Capital reporter, Jonathan Osting, as we talk about Healthy Michigan, the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act that began today in our state. And this new program is based only on income, correct? And that differs from the way things worked in the past?
Yeah, traditional Medicare was available to new and expectant mothers and some really, really low-income people. But this essentially raises the bar for anyone who earns under 133% of the federal poverty level, which is about $16,000 for a single person or $33,000 for a family of four. It's expected to bring, you know, hundreds of thousands of new residents into the Medicaid program, as opposed to having them go out and purchase insurance on healthcare.gov.
Mm-hmm. Now, there has been some confusion for Michiganders who thought they had previously signed up, but now the state's telling them, no, no, you need to reapply. Can you tell us what happened and what's the latest?
Yeah, well, it seems to be another healthcare.gov issue, which is the federal website for signing up. That system was supposed to flag the state for people who might qualify for traditional Medicaid, so before the Healthy Michigan expansion. Unfortunately, the state said it didn't receive complete data sets from the federal government, so not enough information to actually process those claims. And it was something like 50,000 claims, 80,000 residents impacted. And they're asking all those people to now sign up again through the state website because they simply didn't get enough information from the federal government to move forward.
And if people were disqualified in the past from getting Medicaid, it's important, based on what you're telling us, don't assume because you were not eligible in the past that you're not eligible now, because you may be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's some flexibility on who will be covered, and certainly the state wants everybody who thinks they might to try again. Don't be discouraged. It's, you know, obviously in the best interest of the state to have healthy residents who are incentivized for these healthy behaviors, and they want to make sure everybody who does qualify gets signed up.
And Jonathan, this is supposed to save Michigan hundreds of millions of dollars eventually. Is there a plan for where that savings would go, what it would be used for?
There's not a direct plan. The idea actually is to bank some of that savings, because while the state is going to save some general fund dollars initially, the federal government's contribution is going to gradually decline. So the state wants to save some of that money to sort of offset any costs that might incur down the line. And in fact, the program also includes a so-called trigger switch that would end the expanded eligibility if eventually down the line those costs outweigh the state savings. So again, these are all sort of provisions put in there, I think, to win over some of the Republican members who might otherwise have been skeptical of going along with the Affordable Care Act.
Now, it's important for anyone who might feel that they are eligible to be a part of Healthy Michigan. Is there a deadline to sign up for Medicaid, or can someone sign up as needed?
Well, there's not a deadline. Obviously, there is a deadline for simply having health coverage now in the state, and that deadline has passed. So everybody is supposed to have health care or face a possible penalty from the federal government. That said, in the Healthy Michigan plan, if you sign up later this month, that coverage will be retroactive to April 1. So if you're not able to sign up today for whatever reason, you end up doing it later in the week, you're not going to face any penalties. They'll consider you enrolled as of April 1.
Sorting out Healthy Michigan, the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act right here in Michigan. MLive Capital correspondent Jonathan Osting. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks so much for having me.
A newly released report is breaking new ground in the study of inequality among our children. This national report is from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for Kids Count. It's entitled Race for Results, Building a Path to Opportunity for All Children. And for the first time, it creates an index that looks at conditions for children by race. My next guest believes it contains troubling findings for Michigan children and the need for a major call to action. Jane Zender Merrill is Project Director of Kids Count in Michigan with the Michigan League for Public Policy. Jane, good to have you back on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Can you help us understand how this new Race for Results Index works and what it tells us?
Basically, what the national project did was to take 12 indicators across childhood and into early adulthood and compile percentages based on statistics for that, and then from that, did a 1,000-point index across all 12 indicators. And what it is an index of 0 to 1,000. And nationally, Asian Pacific Islander children had the highest score. They were at 776 out of 1,000 points, compared to 345 for African American children.
And that's
nationwide.
And that's nationwide.
That's
okay.
Nationwide. Mm-hmm. So we have a 400-point gap between our kids that are doing really quite well and our kids that are not doing very well. And what this really does is present compelling evidence that race, ethnicity does make a difference for kids in terms of the conditions in which they live and the outcomes that they show.
And I think underpinning everything that you and I are going to talk about is the belief that is held by Kids Count that we have to find ways to allow success for all children so they can contribute to progress in our state and in our nation. So that's the foundation.
Exactly. And what's troubling in this report for Michigan in particular is that the two largest racial ethnic groups in our state, whites and African American children, are the ones that have below average results compared to the national average. We're about 50 points short for white children and 100 points below the national average for African American children.
And understanding the national average for African American children was pretty horrible to begin with.
Yes, and very low to begin with.
So here is Michigan. So ideal, best of all worlds, the score would be 1,000, and Michigan's African American children checked in at 244.
Yes.
Where does that put us in the rankings of the 50 states?
We're third from the bottom. We're one point away from Mississippi. They're at 245, I believe, and we're at 244. So it's very troubling to look at these statistics and think about it, what it means in terms of the future of our state and our ability to be competitive, not only nationally but globally, in the 21st century.
And for white children in Michigan, and again reminding everybody that 1,000 is like the best score. So nationally, white children were at 704, and here in Michigan they were at 668, which you also find very troubling. Where does that put Michigan in the ranking?
Well, Michigan is around 34th in the rankings across the states. We are well below the national average in math proficiency for eighth graders, reading proficiency for fourth graders, our young adults having an associate's degree or more, and our children growing up in families that have adequate funds to meet basic needs. And that's really above 200% of the poverty level.
Knowing that you work so closely, you know, trying to help children here in Michigan and help families, what do you think is behind this, Jane?
I think that families have suffered terribly in this economic downturn. The high unemployment, our escalating rates of child poverty, and among young children, it's even higher, and it's not slowed down, it's leveling out, but we're over a decade of economic distress. And many families are now working at jobs that don't pay as much as their jobs did before. So the economic struggles of families have been profound. And at that very time, the state has cut back on programming to help families in economic distress. And we have not expanded on key programs that help parents work, like the child care subsidy, like the earned income tax credit. We have not invested in those programs. We are now starting to invest in early childhood, but we have not made substantial investments in early childhood until recent years. Plus, we're shifting the burden of higher education to families. That's another issue. Adult basic education, we've basically defunded so that youngsters who fall off track in the K-12 system, it's very difficult for them to get back on track to get an education at a higher level.
So as I think what I'm hearing you say is a statement that I saw from the Michigan League for Public Policy, and that is the fact that the public systems designed to help children and families are actually functioning in ways that actually deny opportunity, especially to people in color, and pushing them even further down the ladder.
I think, yes, that would be a fair assessment. And certainly this report shows us the outcomes for kids, what's happening across our state.
I'm talking with Jane Zender Merrill, who's project director of Kids Count in Michigan, as we explore the new report from Kids Count done by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. It's called Race for Results, Building a Path to Opportunity for All Children. And Jane, you see this as a call to action. What do you see as the call to action here in Michigan?
Well, definitely we can look at some public policy decisions that we could make to target some of these issues. Like, we're not talking about what is happening in our urban areas. I mean, Detroit has been all over the news around bankruptcy, but many of our school districts are struggling. We also have many families that are struggling since the earned income tax credit that we had at 20% fell to 6%. That 20% used to lift a lot more families with children above the poverty level. And really, the earned income tax credit helps families with children. That's its target. The other critical piece of support for working families is the child care subsidy. We're making a lot of investments in quality, but we're not addressing the fact that we don't pay extra for quality in the subsidy and that the subsidy level has not kept up with inflation. And certainly raising the state minimum wage so that when people work, they're making a wage that will help them meet their basic needs.
It seems that much of what you're saying in this call to action has to happen in Lansing.
Yes, I think that's one, particularly for African-American children, because they live in neighborhoods with high poverty, there are not going to be resources in their neighborhoods to make up for the shortfall in their families. So part of what has to be done is that the state level more effort to apply the resources into targeted areas to help families who are living in high poverty areas. We need an urban agenda. Transportation is a huge issue. Access to jobs is an issue. We have some of the highest unemployment in the country for African Americans. So all of these factors have an interplay that creates disadvantage in the long run for children.
But then what do you say to lawmakers who say, well, look, I represent a rural area and we have our own set of struggles and I don't agree that there should be an urban agenda? How do you get people singing from the same page of the hymnal?
It's a challenge. But I think when we look at what's happening statewide and that this is our largest minority group, that when we allow 16% of our children not to have what they need to be successful, we all suffer in the long run. And we will not be competitive across the states nor in a global economy with 16% of our children not able to survive as adults effectively and become taxpayers, parents, workers that are living up to their potential.
And then, as you pointed out, the report finds that the 69% of Michigan's children who are white are also behind the curve of their peers in other states. So if Michigan doesn't take action, what do you fear will be the result?
Well, we certainly won't be able to look to make the economic comeback or revitalization that needs to happen. The jobs of the 21st century require higher education. And that's one of the indicators where we don't perform very well compared to other states and the national average. So, you know, we all have a concern about the economic well-being of our state so people can take care of themselves and take care of their children. So we all have an investment in how this goes forward.
Jane Zender Merrill, Project Director of Kids Count in Michigan with the Michigan League for Public Policy. And this Annie E. Casey Foundation report for Kids Count, again, is entitled Race for Results, Building a Path to Opportunity for All Children. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside, Jane.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And that's our program for today. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennis-Ketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.
You're listening to Michigan Radio, your NPR news station.